This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Group C and D preview of The Guardian Football Weekly. Is it scripted to be Lionel Messi's World Cup? Will that save football? Group C has a classic World Cup look to it. Mexico, essential for any World Cup to add some green and some come second and get knocked out in the last 16 vibes. Poland to make up the numbers and Saudi Arabia, who for some reason are playing in Newcastle's away kit this time around. Speaking of kits, some wonderful matchups in Group D with France, Denmark, Australia and Tunisia. The holders France have injury worries, but still some great players while the Danes appear to be everyone's dark horses, so expect them to crash out. The Socceroos are Galactico light right now, while Tunisia, well, I'm looking forward to learning about them in a minute. Also today, as part of our series into Qatar off the pitch, we take a detailed look at the lives and experiences of the LGBTQI plus community there and speak to the only openly gay Qatari man. As always, we'll answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today for parts one and two, Marcela Mora y Araujo, the klaxon, has been sounded for Argentina discussion. How are you, Marcela? It's always nice to speak to you.
Hello. Nice to see you all.
Hello, Mark Langdon.
Hello, Max.
And hello, Philippe Auclair.
Good morning to you, Max.
Chris says, are people rooting for Messi? Should they? Shouldn't they? Tell me what to think, Marcela. It feels, you know, I mean, there's been so much talk about lots of things in the build-up for this World Cup, but on the pitch, a lot has been said about Lionel Messi, and is this his time?
I think it is. I think, yes, we should all be rooting for Messi. He's definitely come into his own somehow. There's this leader, mature, confident Messi, and, well, I'm in Buenos Aires right now, and the love in here is just unbelievable. Having watched him progress through so many stages of his relationship with Argentina, where, you know, it's at times been fraught, at times it seemed that it weighs heavily on him, at times it seems the country is angry with him. This is the absolute kind of harmony moment of the Messi that has finally achieved, you know, the big important international title for the country. The Copa America, he's finally at ease. He's playing incredibly well. I don't know what demons he's liberated himself from. Perhaps Maradona's death is the thing that enabled him to step up. Perhaps leaving Barcelona has something to do with it. It's like he's freed himself from chains. And whereas most of his career, of course, we know he grew up in Barcelona practically. He joined as a very young kid. Most of his career, he was the perfect element of a perfect machine in Barcelona. And he did so, so well. And then he would join the Argentina national squad and that wouldn't be emulated. And so it seemed that he couldn't quite deliver for country what he could for club. His move to Paris seems to have shifted that. And there was a point when he wasn't quite delivering for Paris Saint-Germain, but he was doing increasingly well with Argentina. And now it's like he is a perfect balance of both. So I can't imagine a more perfect time for Messi to shine. The only thing that worries me is that obviously this, you know, Nirvana is kind of could turn into a monster of its own making. So anything now short of this brilliance is going to be a huge anticlimax and disappointment.
Philippe, would you like to see Messi lift the World Cup?
The ambassador of the Saudi Tourist Board. Yes, of course, I would love to see that. Which, of course, is going to be a huge problem with him when he plays against the away Newcastle, as you were saying, Newcastle in the group phase. I suppose so. I suppose so. I have to say that I am perhaps not as great a fan of him that as Marcela obviously is. But if you took a look at things more realistically, for once, the idea that it would be a win or a failure, I think when you look at this Argentinian team, and if you look at the competition, you say, yeah. Yeah, if they don't win it, it would be a failure. They're my favorite, and there are many people's favorites. They haven't had as balanced a team as this one for a while, and he seems to be as walking on water. I mean, he's been absolutely tremendous for PSG this season, which is quite extraordinary when you think about it. And you thought last year when we were talking about him, we were talking about his injuries, which was something quite new in his career. We were talking about his lack of. I mean, he wasn't scoring goals and he wasn't even making them. He was really a shadow of himself. And this year, we're back to the very best Messi. So would I be happy for him? Up to a point, my dear Max. I'm going to be very diplomatic about that because I wouldn't want to hurt the feelings of dear Marcelo.
No, that's fine.
And of the Argentinian people whom I hold dearly in my heart and whose colours I love and whose flag I respect. But... maybe.
You're allowed to have your own feelings, Philippe. We know them all too well. Mark, Philippe talked about the balance of Argentina. Can you talk us through that balance? Do you share his view on that?
I definitely think it is a more balanced team. They've gone into previous World Cups, maybe not convincing in terms of like the goalkeeper situation. And Emi Martinez has definitely... steadied that particular area of the team. Christian Romero and Otamendi feels like it maybe shouldn't work as a centre-back pairing because they are quite an aggressive duo. And Romero, I think, has been absolutely outstanding since he found his way into that Argentinian team. And, you know, there are some players that maybe put club before country. I think it's Romero maybe the other way around. When the Premier League was finishing, he was sending out tweets of him in his Argentina kit, just getting ready to start preparations. I think in midfield, Giovanni Lo Celso, when I've watched Argentina in the last couple of years, he is somebody that has linked that team really perfectly from the midfield in terms of getting the ball to Messi. And so his injury... I'm not sure who's going to come in to replace him, but I don't know if they've got a player just quite like Lo Celso that can do that job as neatly as what he did. Up front, there are absolutely no doubts. If it's Messi and Lautaro Martinez, you've got Di Maria, who again is another one of those players that's fresh, hasn't done as much at Juventus as maybe the Juventus fans will have liked. The one area I was looking at when Philippe was calling them favourites, and one area I just wondered about the fullbacks and whether that might be a slight weakness in them. You could say the same maybe about Brazil as well. And if you are to have an area where you're maybe not as strong, I think in the fullback areas is probably the place to be.
It's interesting, Marcelo, you talked about, you know, a generational thing, obviously, between, you know, Maradona and Messi. You know, life moves on, doesn't it? In my mind, it's like Argentina win the World Cup quite a lot. But, you know, it hasn't been since 1986, right? You know, do they talk of, you know, it's what, 36 years of hurt now?
The Copa America win was so significant because it broke a kind of, you know, a spell or some sort of gualicho that... We hadn't won anything internationally important, but we'd been close, you know, Copa America finals, the 2014 final. And I think, although that's, to me, that shows how well Argentina continued to do. It's not like we won a World Cup years ago and then nothing ever happened. Continuously close. There's a really nice kind of, growth to this squad, though, because there was a time when José Pekerman took over the youth sides of Argentina and completely revolutionized the way, the seriousness with which, international level we worked with kids and the approach to training and teaching and grooming them in a way, you know, to be wholesome humans. And now it's that generation that is leading the squad. So I think, I mean, I have a lot to say about the players and the Lo Celso injury, and I think Argentina playing a friendly today in Saudi Arabia, and I think Julian Alvarez might be in there, who I rate enormously. But the team doing the work, the trainings, Lionel Scaloni and his accolades, who are Pablo Aimar, Walter Samuel and Roberto Ayala, three of the best players of their generation at the time, both club and for Argentina, youth and, you know, first team, they have taken on the training and the preparation of the squad since, you know, for the last 4 years, really since the 2018 debacle. And there's something really nice and wholesome about the way they're working. They're low profile. They're not scandalous. They don't appear in the media much. And they're close in age to some of the players. In fact, Scaloni was working with Sampaoli in 2018, and he says he stayed on partly because he could tell he had a good rapport with the players when all hell was breaking loose. So that makes me feel that, you know, winning the trophy itself is kind of less important than sustaining this rhythm, if you like, of just bringing in the young players. 19 of these players have never played a World Cup. I read the other day somewhere Argentina are old and experienced, and that will bode well for them. They're not old and experienced. 19 have never played a World Cup, and yet they've won a Copa America. So it's that wonderful combination of, you know, youth. Yeah, we can do anything. I hope it doesn't go to their heads. I hope they're not overconfident. I know what Philippe means by there's, you know, point which you think, meh, it's just too straightforward, you know, and then Argentina won. But if they can enjoy the football the way they have, if they can play like they did in Copa America, if Messi can delight whilst himself looking delighted, then to me, that's mission accomplished. You know, whether or not there's four at the back, it seems almost like a, you know, a plot from a different movie. But I do actually think the defenders are quite well. I mean, Otamendi isn't one of the 19 who've never played a World Cup before. But I do think we need someone with his kind of, you know, slightly scary anger to hold fort.
Well, look, the three teams that they have to get past to get into the knockouts, Mexico, Poland and Saudi Arabia. We may not give them quite the amount of time we give Argentina. Forgive us, please. Mexico, as I said, Philippe, they have to be at a World Cup. They have to get out of the group and they have to get knocked out in the last 16. And that has happened every World Cup since 1994.
All series come to an end. And I'm wondering if this might not be the World Cup at which this, unfortunately, this comes to an end. The reason for that, and I'm saying that with a tremolo in my voice because I really want them to do well. They've got the best shirt at this World Cup by a considerable distance. It is a thing of absolute beauty, which was done by the Museo Antropologico de Mexico, and which is magnificent. But apart from that,
yes.
It is beautiful. And the thing is, it's basically the same team. You know, Tata Martino has basically taken the team that he's been with for a while. They did well in the qualifiers up to a point. If you look at what they did there, they finished equal on points with Canada, and which is fine. Everybody was talking about Canada doing something extraordinary. Nobody talks about Mexico. But the thing is that their performances were poor. They really struggled against the better teams in that CONCACAF group. Some of their players, their main players, are not the players they used to be. Everybody would know Raul Jimenez, and everybody would know that Raul Jimenez is not the player he used to be. He's actually left out of the squad a few young players that many people in Mexico would have liked to be in that squad. And he's relying on a system, his good old 4-3-3. I think, honestly, you could almost literally name every single one of those players by looking at the previous World Cup. And perhaps the only one player whom I can get a bit excited about is Alexis Vega, who was their top scorer in the qualifiers with, hold on, 2 goals. That shows you that they have a problem. Loads of players who scored 1 goal, and only 2, I think, scored 2 goals. And one of them is Alexis Vega, who is young, is only 24, is a great talent, could be a great stage. But also the atmosphere back home, I'm told by my family there, because I've got some family there, which also explains why I'm a little bit partial to them, is that all the knives are already drawn against Tata Martino. And their first game, if I'm not mistaken, is the one that could take them out of the World Cup.
Yes, Poland first, yeah.
Because they play Poland. If they lose against Poland, that's it. That is honestly it, because Saudi Arabia are so bad that, you know, actually discount them. Discount Saudi Arabia.
Okay, fine. That's that preview done. So Mark, who will win out of Poland and Mexico? Poland always seemed to me as a kind of sort of making up the numbers sort of feeling about them at World Cups. You need them there. You know they're not going to do anything, and that's fine. That's sort of where everybody is happy with.
Yeah, I mean, I would make it almost 50-50 between Mexico and Poland in terms of that. I wouldn't be surprised if that game finished in a draw. You get these World Cup matches where both teams know if they lose, they could almost be out before the tournament starts, and there is that backward step taken. A Poland play Argentina last, which I think could be an advantage. If Argentina get their first two wins on the board, and as we've spoken, it looks like they will, maybe there's rotation for that final game. Maybe a draw could even suit both teams. So that might be an advantage for Poland. They're not a one-man team, but Lewandowski carries a lot of their hopes. I mean, it's quite obvious, to say that. I think early on in his Poland career, he struggled because there just wasn't the service up to him. And he's not somebody like Messi that can drop deep, dribble past five players and then smash it into the corner or curl it into the corner, or is more the Messi way. Lewandowski does need a certain amount of service. He's not somebody who just hangs around the box, but still needs people to get the ball to him. And in the last Euros, Poland went out early, but at least Lewandowski looked like the Lewandowski that we saw at Bayern Munich and for Barcelona. I think if you look at somebody like Zielinski at Napoli, he can provide him with a decent amount of service. Be interesting to see who partners Lewandowski up front, because Milik, injury prone though he is, has actually done really well for Juventus. And if he could get his way back into that starting 11 up front with Lewandowski and Zielinski in behind, that might just give them the edge over Mexico. The rest of the team, particularly the spine, I think is well known, from previous tournaments. Chesney in goal, Glick, the kind of warrior at the back, and Krikoviak is still in central midfield with Lewandowski up front. So, I mean, I just going back to Mexico, it wouldn't be the first time that Mexico have gone into a World Cup with the fans not liking certain aspects of whether it's the team, the style, the manager. They are, I think in terms of supporters going to Qatar, they'd be among the sort of heavily supported teams there. And it wouldn't amaze me if Mexico played better than what we've seen of them, because it's a World Cup. And, I don't want to sit on the fence too much, Max, but I am going to. I don't see how anyone can have a really strong opinion on whether Poland or Mexico goes through.
But at least one thing we can be sure of is that Saudi Arabia will not go out of the group.
Are we sure about that? They have former Cambridge manager Hervé Renard.
Hervé Renard.
Ah, okay.
Hervé.
Yes, Marcella?
No, I agree. Saudi Arabia are really likely to stay on, I think, because also they will have a local advantage, whatever that weighs for, but significant, because we're all from another planet in that part of the world, which I think is exciting.
I was listening to Mark speaking with a smile on my face and uttering silent prayers to the Virgen de Guadalupe, thinking, yes, absolutely, they will go through, but I don't think so. But Saudi Arabia, I think one thing that really amused me is I looked at their results this year. It's a perfect digital team.
It's binary numbers, isn't it?
1-0-0-1, 1-1-0-0, 1-0-0-1. And to be honest, their results have been absolutely appalling. Absolutely appalling. The last game was a 1-1 against Panama. They drew against Albania, Honduras. They drew against China, which is really taking... You really have got to be really bad to draw with China. And no, honestly, they'll be very heavily supported, by the way. That's true. Loads of people will cross the border to go and support them. That might play some role, but it would be a huge surprise if they got 1 point from that group.
Well, Marcella, thanks so much for coming on. We'll no doubt speak to you as the tournament progresses.
It would be lovely to come back. can discuss with Philippe how Argentina and France face off for the second phase of the tournament. We dispense with Tata Martino first, make him pay for his sins against Argentina, and then move on to face France. Lovely to see you all.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do Group D.
Erst 8 Stunden Arbeit, danach zum Training und jetzt sollst du noch was Richtiges kochen? Ja, das geht. Mit HelloFresh. Wähle einfach protein- und vitaminreiche Rezepte aus und erhalte genau die richtigen Zutaten in deiner HelloFresh-Box. So planst du deine Woche und Mahlzeiten easy und landest nicht immer nur bei Pizza und Pommes. Jetzt kannst du bis zu 100 sportliche Euro auf deine ersten 4 HelloFresh-Boxen sparen. Mit dem Code FSSPORT100.
Well, welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Football Weekly Live, the hourly tweets have started. My apologies to everybody, but it is being live streamed around the world. So until we sell 7 billion tickets, got to keep plugging it. Theguardian.com/Guardian Live. We are from Earth in Hackney and around the Earth on the internet. Me, Barry, Lars, Ellis, James, some special guests. I can't give any more information than that. But some of your favourite panellists may be turning up too. Right. Alistair says, will anyone do a World Cup preview and not predict that France would either win the tournament or crash out in the group stages? JP says, no Pogba, no Kante, a dodgy Benzema. How much will Australia win the opening game by? So Group D is Australia, Denmark, Tunisia and France. And let's start with France and your pal Didier Deschamps-Philippe. How do you see it? And Nkunku is out. I mean, that's the latest news, isn't it? Camavinga injured him in training, which is always a good start.
Yeah, we've won the World Cup of injuries, I think, by quite a distance already. So obviously, N'Golo Kante and Paul Pogba, basically the midfield which gave France the World Cup in 2018. Mike Maignan, that was a real blow because he was doing superbly, the AC Milan keeper. Presnel Kimpembe, I'm not too sure that's much of a problem because, to be honest, I always had the jitters when I saw his name on the team sheet. And also there are players, and that's one of the problems which meant that Didier Deschamps only gave a list of 25 and not 26 players, is that there are a number of players about whom there are doubts, who are carrying niggles, and we don't know exactly which state they're going to be in. And obviously some important players. I mean, I think Raphaël Varane is obviously one. Who would be automatic choice. Lucas Hernandez is back. Not sure that he's back to his best level, but he's back. Now we're starting to fret about Karim Benzema, who only trained for 10, 15 minutes at Clairefontaine yesterday before they flew out to Qatar today. And it was a precautionary measure, but as you will have seen, he hasn't played for Real Madrid for a while. There's also the impact of the Ballon d'Or on the head of a player. We knew it can have a negative impact. And there are other players who are also like Jules Koundé is in the squad. But again, he's missed Barcelona's last few games. So the squad is in a really, is as bad a state physically as it was before the 2002 World Cup. And you probably will remember what happened there. And I would agree that it could be all the way or crashing out at the group stage. Which would be very, very French. And I don't feel confident at all. The problems that other teams have got with their fullbacks, I think France also has them up to a point. And it's our midfield, honestly. I can't see anybody who is quite as good as, you know, obviously Pogba and Kanté together for France. I mean, the Pogba-Kanté association we saw for France was truly special, spectacular, and absolutely decisive. And what we have now, we have players like Tchouaméni, My old friend, whose name I don't have to mention. Everybody will know who I'm talking about and who will probably start. People are talking about Youssouf Fofana as being a possible starter. Well, look at the number of caps he's gone. I mean, it's not exactly a midfield that inspires confidence. And I'd love to have Mark's considered judgment on that, if my pessimism is something that he shares.
Yeah, I mean, I think from that midfield would be the concern for me, really, because it was such a strength of the French team when they won the World Cup, the way that they were so disciplined, but also were able to follow Deschamps' game plan, and Pogba, for all that he gets, when he was in the Premier League, that there were people that were criticising him. I think in the French national team, the majority of the time, he was absolutely fine and one of the best players and most important players within that team. So to lose somebody like Pogba does feel like a big thing. And I was just looking at that the midfield, and I'm sure that, in 3 or 4 years' time, Tchouameni and Camavinga will be absolutely perfect in that position. But when you look at Veretout, Guendouzi, Rabiot, I mean, let's just say the jury's out, I think, in terms of some of them players as to whether they're up to the standard maybe of sort of French midfields in years gone past. And I think that strength in depth was always sort of considered the reason why France were many people's favourites at the last Euros and one of the favourites for the World Cup because in 2018, because they had so many players. Now, I mean, just throwing it back to Philippe, all the quality really feels like it's in the attacking third of the pitch, even without Nkunku. You've got Mbappe, you've got Benzema, you've got Kingsley Coman, there's Ousmane Dembele as well, Griezmann, Giroud. How many of them do you think will get into the starting 11? How would Deschamps sort of look to line that team up?
I think 4-3-1-2. With Griezmann in a kind of withdrawn position and with Benzema and Mbappé up front, with Mbappé on the left and Benzema a kind of slightly right but centre-y and permutation, obviously, but Griezmann being a kind of almost number 10, in that team. But again, Benzema, I agree with you, but Benzema, his physical state and his mental state, we're not too sure about. Griezmann has been playing 30 minutes per game because of its strange contractual situation. Mbappé has had a very complicated year in terms of mental problems and problems with his club. I mean, he's scored some absolutely unbelievable goals and he's played some wonderful football, but he also hasn't been quite as together as we would hope him to be. And the other thing we shouldn't forget is that the atmosphere within the French Federation at the moment is absolutely catastrophic. And that is bound to have an impact. It's Deschamps' last big competition. There's no doubt about that. There's the growing shadow of a certain Zinedine Zidane behind him. And there's a feeling that everything is falling apart at the French FA. So the atmosphere is awful, absolutely awful. The fact that Giroud is going is not a guarantee that the atmosphere in the dressing room is going to be the best, because there are camps in that French dressing room as well. So for all these reasons,
who can dislike Olivier Giroud?
I don't, but okay. Some do. Oh, many people do in France. People think, oh, he's not worth his place
because he's about to get. He could get the French, goal scoring record, and he's not. He's not like a elite table one footballer, is he?
I think it annoys a lot of people that Olivier Giroud could become France's all time, greatest goal scorer. I think there are loads of people it annoys. Really, yes, and the atmosphere. The atmosphere is poor, and it does remind me too much of 2002, where we arrived without Robert Pires. Had been injured for Arsenal. Zizou was not ready and injured himself. He was forced to play in a stupid friendly against Korea and then was brought back later on in the competition, but to no avail. They're against, the first game is against Australia, right? And an Australian team that basically will have absolutely no fear, no compunction. They'll go there. They've stated quite high ambitions. I think their coach said, oh, why not the quarterfinals? Which is okay, guys, yeah, well done.
What, the Australia coach?
Yeah! I think that's
get on to
that's optimism. But
really
why shouldn't they pose huge problems to that French team if they approach it with the spirit with which they will approach it, which is they're really tearing to them. I'm absolutely convinced of that. And how this France team responds, I don't know. Then we've got Denmark. And heaven knows that we fear Denmark, and you just have to see the games we played against Denmark in 2022 to understand why we have every reason to fear them. And then we think, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
The fear factor will be there, and it just basically have to win against Australia. Even if it's 1-0 at the 97th minute, we don't care. Then things might be okay. But I'm approaching this game with a certain amount of trepidation, I must say.
I will be amazed if Australia tear into France, but we'll get to them in a second. One more question on France, which is from Benji. He says, has Hugo Lloris missed the point with the armband? He was asked about whether he'd wear a rainbow armband or not. And he said, when we're in France, when we welcome foreigners, we often want them to follow our rules to respect our culture. And I will do the same when I go to Qatar, quite simply. I can agree or disagree with our ideas, but I have to show respect. Interesting, on the day that we put out the LGBTQ plus special, Philippe, which was in part three for this pod, it's missing the point.
Well, I think he is. I think it's his comments rather than the decision, in a way, because as you will hear, the discussions we've had with people who are in Qatar, people who are members of the LGBT community, they do not see manifestations of so-called support for them, open manifestations, as being necessarily a good thing. But this is not the reason why Lloris is not going to wear the armband. The reason why he's not going to wear the armband is to me, it's pure submission. I think it's quite cowardly, really. And it's the way he's been perceived by almost absolutely everybody in France as well. So that's yet another thing to add, is that it was not a very popular gesture, and he didn't explain himself very well. And when they also said that his opinion was very much the opinion of President of the French FA, Noël Le Graët, who is one of the most disliked and sometimes more men in French football, I don't think he chose the right words. Even if you could say that this armband is actually quite an empty gesture in some ways, it won't be for some people, it will be for others. And again, as you will hear, for people who are in Qatar, they're very, they have a problem with Westerners coming and making a fuss about their own hell that they have to live in, saying that, in fact, if you do that, all you risk is to be deported, put on a plane, that's it. They have to stay there, and they will pay for the consequences. So, but anyway, that's a discussion that we'll have a little bit later.
Absolutely. So they play Australia in the first game. Graham Arnold's team got past Peru in a penalty shootout. Their sub-goalkeeper, James Redmayne. That's not James Redmayne. I was at university with James Redmayne. What's his name? Andrew Redmayne. Yeah, that's it. their sub-goalkeeper, Andrew Redmayne, did the wobbly legs and got them through against Peru and sort of shit-housed the Peru keeper by throwing the bottle with the water bottle with all the tactics of the Australian penalty takers. Australian football, from my perspective, is sort of in constant existential crisis about what they are, about who they are, about how good the A-League or how bad the A-League is, about how well football is supported. I mean, the truth is that the football fans there love football as much as anybody I know, and they will watch this tournament through the night. But I don't know if they have high hopes for this team, Mark. They don't have any Galacticos, right? You know, there was a time when Australia had three or four absolutely elite players, and they just don't have that. And I think a sort of side effect of that is the obsession with Ange Postecoglou, because he is an Australian doing good things, right? I would say amazing, but doing good things over in Europe. They just don't have that on the pitch anymore. Matty Ryan is not getting a game for Copenhagen. Aaron Moyes isn't starting that often for Celtic. There's no one really in the Premier League doing anything. And so Philippe said, look, they could tear into France. I just don't think that'll be the way they start this tournament.
No. The times when I've seen them, I mean, they don't really tear into sort of teams when they're in their own qualifying sort of pool. So I think they will take a backward step against France. And that would be the best way to try to get anything out of the game. I mean, we've spoken a lot about the injuries every team is going to go into this World Cup with players that are not 100% fitness. But even this week, Boyle, who plays in Scotland, is somebody that's suffering from a knee injury, might not make the World Cup, and it would certainly be, as we speak, a doubt for that opening game. Hristic, who plays, who won the Europa League last season, who plays in Italy, he's been injured as well. Now, of course, you might say, well, that means they can come into the action fresh and that they haven't been playing this kind of crazy schedule. But I do feel like you need some kind of rhythm, and then match fitness becomes another issue as well for players. You know, you've got this World Cup is condensed, so you're playing three matches in sort of 9 or 10 days, and if you're not fully fit, I don't see how you'll be able to do that. And you look at the sort of squad depth; it's not there as far as Australia are concerned. I mean, I was looking at that game. I just think this is quite a simple group to predict in terms of who goes through, with the big European teams coming through in first and second, and you know, Australia and Tunisia being quite a bit behind in that respect. Yeah, I don't share any that kind of Graham Arnold. I didn't see the quote, but if he's saying quarterfinals, I think he's setting the Socceroo supporters up for a disappointment.
Let's talk about Denmark then. A lot of people's dark horses. They did well at the Euros, didn't they? And we can all agree, probably wasn't a penalty that England got in extra time. Now they're not going to go back and replay that moment. And also, it feels like, Philippe, kind of, you know, it's a last World Cup for a lot of Danish old stages. Of course, Christian Eriksen, we remember that day, as a lot of people do in the Euros.
He's only 30. Is he? You know?
Okay. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. So do you think not the last one for him and Schmeichel and Højbjerg? Maybe.
Schmeichel. Yeah. Schmeichel. Yes. And I think there are some people who would say that Schmeichel is perhaps not exactly the keeper he used to be. And there's a mixture of. I mean, first of all, it's. I don't think they're dark horses. What's the opposite of a dark horse?
Just a horse, isn't it?
It's just a light horse. Yeah. Because there are many people's favorite to actually top the group. So I don't think it would be any surprise whatsoever if they did well, because everybody's got in mind what they did at the Euro, where honestly we thought they were, that's it. And what they managed to surmount and the amount of togetherness they showed, the talent that is in their team. I mean, that's pretty impressive for a country of 6 million inhabitants, and I don't think that would be a surprise at all to see. And also they haven't had also the problems with injuries. I think the only one that most other teams have had, I think the only slide doubt is around Andreas Christensen, isn't it, Mark? Who is, you know, so is fit, but we don't exactly know what his physical state is. Otherwise, all the other guys are there, you know, the Kjaers, Thomas Delaney, Højbjerg, Eriksen, they're all there, and they will be fit. And because of that, they look solid, they look calm, and they look, for me, favourites to top this group, if I'm absolutely honest.
And I think, topping the group, we always try and work out how the draw will sort of develop, and it never seems to ring true. But if we assume that Argentina win Group C, winning Group D is absolutely massive, because you will avoid Argentina. You go into the other half of the draw. Most people are expecting Brazil and Argentina to be in the top half. The bottom half, if you win that group, would be the runner-up in Group C, so Mexico or Poland, and we've spoken about their issues, and then you're into a quarterfinal, which is seeded to be England, who again I think have got those vulnerabilities. And as you mentioned, Max, you know, it was a harsh penalty against Denmark, a game that was at Wembley in the semi-final. It wouldn't take much for Denmark to turn that form around, really. They've already beaten France home and away in 2022. I don't know how much value we need to put on that Nations League, because were teams trying in terms of the maximum of their ability, I'm sure there'll be a little bit more effort come the World Cup. But I share kind of Philippe's optimism around Denmark, and maybe therefore it's pessimism around France, because they just look like a really solid together international team that's not going to concede many goals. And you're adding Eriksen into a team that reached the semi-final of the Euros, and he's playing at a level that I don't think, you know, anybody really dreamed he would get back to, and it's fantastic to see. I think that they are a team that could go far, but they will need to win the group.
Worth mentioning, you know, we talked about Hugo Lloris and his statement. It's worth mentioning both the Socceroos. They did an excellent video, didn't they? The squad got together, talked about human rights and unions and LGBTQ plus rights. The Danes as well, you know, the kit is... the badge is kind of faded. They wanted to wear a training kit called human rights for all, which FIFA said no. Thomas Delaney said, ask any football player, he'll call it a disaster. He said in a documentary about the World Cup being in Qatar, that's how I see it. No one here thinks it's a good idea. Kasper Schmeichel, I'm glad I'll be playing in a World Cup. Am I content with where it's being held? No, I'm not. I can't change it, only voice my dissatisfaction. And Jakob Jensen says it will not host any fan areas in Qatar. We don't want to support the country. So interesting. The most sort of, I guess, most socially conscious group possibly in the World Cup with Denmark and Australia. Tunisia, their manager Jad El Khadri has several head coaching jobs at clubs in Tunisia, Saudi Arabia and Libya, I am reading, has been twice an assistant coach for Tunisia. They've got the 19-year-old Hannibal you might have seen playing for Manchester United. But beyond that, I don't know a whole lot, and I stare at both of you and I...
Birmingham City's Hannibal Meshbury.
Exactly, yeah.
I think Webby Khazri.
Oh,
you
yeah,
probably
of course.
Have heard of Webby Khazri, yes. Yeah, and he is still the fulcrum of Montpellier, is still the creative fulcrum in a team that is blowing hot and cold, and more cold than hot, I'm afraid. And I don't think that's the best ever Tunisian team to have made it to a World Cup, that's for sure. And their results have been don't quite know what to expect from them. I mean, they've just been absolutely walloped. I mean, they were walloped by Brazil not that long ago, a couple of months ago. And their results haven't been great. But on the other hand, they've done, you know, in the AFCON qualification in particular, they've had some terrible results. But they're a team. I don't exactly know what to expect from them, but I'm not expecting great things, if you see what I mean. I think it will be from... not very good to mediocre is what I would expect from them.
I saw one statistic, Philippe, that said 8 of their last 11 competitive games had featured no more than one goal. So I think I'm pretty confident in terms of their style, what it will be. I know they've changed manager since AFCON, but I thought they were horrible in that tournament. Not the only team that played in a defensive style, but they were beaten by Burkina Faso. But they'd also...
And the Gambia too, yeah.
Yeah, they'd lost a couple of their group games 1-0 as well. So it was a disappointing tournament from them. I suppose that they did win the Kirin Cup against Japan, Chile and Ghana in June. But if we were not sure what to make of the Nations League results, maybe we shouldn't be putting too much stock there. Again, in terms of like finishing third and fourth, I mean, that game against Australia offers both an opportunity to win a World Cup game. And I don't think we should sort of rubbish how much that means. Here we support nations that, you know, are, hoping for more at a World Cup. But for some, being at the World Cup is a tremendous achievement, and winning a World Cup game or scoring a World Cup goal can mean an awful lot to some teams. And I think in terms of Tunisia, they've never managed to get out of the group previously. I don't expect that to change. But the game against Australia offers both teams that opportunity to win.
Right, that'll do for this bit of the podcast. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Philippe. You will hear yourself in part three.
I will. Thank you, Max.
No worries. Guardian Football Weekly. This bit was produced by Joel Grove with Silas Gray, executive produced by Max Sanderson. Coming up next, our second special ahead of the World Cup today, focused on the LGBTQI+ community in Qatar.
Erst 8 Stunden Arbeit, danach zum Training und jetzt sollst du noch was Richtiges kochen? Ja, das geht mit HelloFresh. Wähle einfach protein- und vitaminreiche Rezepte aus und erhalte genau die richtigen Zutaten in deiner HelloFresh-Box. So planst du deine Woche und Mahlzeiten easy und landest nicht immer nur bei Pizza und Pommes. Jetzt kannst du bis zu 100 sportliche Euro auf deine ersten 4 HelloFresh-Boxen sparen mit dem Code FSSPORT100.
Welcome back to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. This is a special on the LGBTQI+ community in Qatar. In this part, we speak to the first openly gay Qatari, Dr. Naz Mohammed, who claimed political asylum in the United States. We'll hear anonymous testimonies of gay and transgender Qataris who still live in the country. And we have a panel of experts who've spent time there. We want to find out as best we can what life is actually like for the LGBTQI+ community in a country where same-sex relations are illegal, carry a punishment of several years in jail, and have their experiences changed for the better or the worse since Qatar was awarded the World Cup. Before we introduce our panel, a few weeks ago, I spoke to Dr. Nasser Mohammed, a gay man who left Qatar in 2011, and this is his story. Tell us about life in Qatar growing up. You said to the Independent interview that you had to sort of grow up anonymous. What was it like?
In Qatar, it's really difficult to have any individual traits that kind of go away from the image that the society would like people to have. So I grew up in a conservative family in Qatar and mostly conforming to most traditional and societal standards till I learned that I was an LGBT person, you know, in my young teens. And, you know, that was something that is absolutely out of my control. I just was learning this about myself. At that time, I would say, like, the way I experienced my young teens was just being extremely avoidant of the topic in general up till I was in high school. And then that's when fear really started to kick in. Fear of being found out. Fear of having to face moments where I would have to get into arranged marriage and form a traditional family. Something that I knew I wasn't able to do. I really started facing the topic in medical school as I was traveling back and forth to the United States. And when I accepted, I should say, that I'm gay, it was a identity crisis moment that's similar to a lot of the coming out moments that LGBT individuals have. But mine was coupled with life crisis because home was not safe anymore. There were no resources to tap into, honestly, at all. Like, there were no people to reach out to, no clear paths from where I was, no way to signal that there was help. So at that time, I decided to just pursue my post-medical training in the United States, and I left with the intention of not going back. I didn't know how, so that was in 2011. And then in 2015, I decided to file for political asylum in the United States and move to San Francisco.
From my experience of chatting to LGBTQ plus people from that community, like, coming out is hard enough in a country where homosexuality is legal, where it is celebrated. To sort of have that experience in a country where I presume, well, what was it like? Like, what was the discussion of homosexuality growing up? Was it ever talked about?
Absent. No. When I was growing up, it was absolutely absent. It was not talked about. There were whispers and rumors and, you know, there's just like, there are a couple of things that really made this, I think, really tough. One of them is the severe persecution for individuals by the government and their own families if they try to come out or if they just speak on the top about the topic. But the fact that also that people function in Qatar as like family units, really. So like a person coming out is not an individual thing. You're outing your whole family.
What was it like telling your family?
Initially, came out to my parents when I decided to file for asylum. So I called my mom and told her I'm not coming back home. And this is why I decided to do that instead of just not going back home and them not knowing why. It was a very difficult conversation because when I had it the first time, I was emotionally caught in it, right? So I was like very defensive. And now, like a few years later, I'm like looking at it just externally. And, you know, she was not armed as a parent with resources and information to understand what is it like to be an LGBT person. And I really do blame the system for that. My mom was initially like shocked, and then she was sad, and then she was asking if I got treatment, which is what they do. They try to fix it in Qatar. That was the beginning of the end, you know, of my relationship with my parents.
You said that in Qatar, the state tries to treat people like you. What do you mean by that?
So this has been shifting from what I've been learning. So I had my own understanding of this. I encountered some of it as a medical student. And then I also got to hear a lot more stories since coming out. And it used to be mandatory. They used to be pretty abrasive about this. But it just has caused a lot of tension, I think, from individuals that were forced to go through it. So now they have to get quote-unquote consent for people to go through it, but there is like really no other choice, you know, but to go through it. So families refer their children, so adolescents like really are forced to go through it in a way by their families. There is a sect of the law enforcement there that quite literally hunts LGBT people, specifically targeting feminine gay men and transgender women, and they subject them to this while they're imprisoned, and then have an order for them to go to conversion therapy sessions post their release. So that's what's going on.
Right, there is less than a month to go until the World Cup kicks off in Qatar, and the country's treatment of the LGBTQ plus community is once again in the spotlight. As a human rights group releases a damning report alleging people are being detained and physically abused by security services.
What would happen if you went back to Qatar now, do you think?
I think I would, at the very minimum, spend like a lot of time in prison, perhaps life in prison. And I think it's not only because of me advocating for LGBT rights, but I think just me speaking against the regime, I think, would be really not tolerated at all. There are people, there are some reports with Amnesty International of people like just opposing certain opinions, having ended up serving life in prison. So I really do, I don't think I can ever go back.
When you speak about that, and then the fact that, you know, FIFA gave Qatar the World Cup, and then obviously, you know, you wrote that open letter to David Beckham, who in the past has, you know, spoken of himself as an ally for the World Cup. And it isn't just Beckham who's taking this money. Lots of people are, you know, are fronting PR campaigns for this World Cup. What do you say to them?
Well, he also blocked me on Instagram this weekend.
Wow.
Exactly. That's exactly how it feels like.
It's another beautiful day here in Qatar.
Welcome to Doha, David.
Beautiful, huh?
This will go down as one of my favorite mornings.
It feels so unjust, and yet it's like this awful accident that's happening and nobody is able to stop it because money is involved. A lot of it is involved. And then it's just crushing, absolutely crushing people like me at home. And, you know, sorry, I'm just a little upset.
That's okay. Take your time.
I have seen this happen, like, with other countries, with other sporting platforms, and now it's happening to us. And it definitely feels very different when it's happening to you. And I just refuse to let it happen, you know?
Fuck, I'm so sorry, mate. One of my big fears, and we will be guilty of this, is that obviously we're talking about this now, and then the World Cup happens, and then, you know, the media circus leaves Qatar, right? We have to talk about, you know, whatever football's happening in January and February, and we won't talk about this, you know? And so I guess you must fear for what, you know, this is such a trite, sort of awful way of putting it. This is a great opportunity, right, to talk about these issues, but in 2 months' time, it all disappears and everyone forgets again. And that must be a huge fear for you, right?
Yes, and that's why I've been scrambling to do the last thing that I think is within my power to do, which is anchoring all the interest and efforts and resources into a nonprofit organization that can then have a mission to continue to bring visibility and support past this moment, not only to Qatar, but to the Gulf region, because this is a pattern that keeps happening in the Gulf region. And there are no independent LGBT voices coming out and speaking about what's actually happening on the ground. And I really, really believe that this is a very important void to fill. So I'm going to try to do it this year.
What can, you know, our audience are football fans, right? But who care about things. That's how I tend to see it, right? What can any of us do? How can we help? What can we do?
So I've been trying to think about this, and I'm trying to think of different people, and I've been trying to think of ways to help and ways not to get hurt at the same time. So I'm hoping that when this nonprofit is up and running, that will be a very clear way to help and support. Supporting that would be supporting the community and pushing the cause. So it would be a very actionable thing for people to do. Another way for people to help and support is by bringing awareness and visibility. If somebody has a platform, give us visibility, because visibility brings help and brings resources. So visibility matters a lot. And then another thing people can do is just give people that are fighting this at home a sense of hope. And I don't have a formed idea of how to do that. People are more than welcome to use my platform if they have specific messages they want to send to the LGBT community in Qatar. They're watching my platforms. Going in and provoking our abusers and leaving, I fear, is not very productive. I think it can just cause local retaliation, and then it can hurt the people doing that too. So I think that's just really not a wise approach. I think there are ways to advocate and show support without being provocative and causing harm to people themselves or to the local community.
Nas, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And like, thank you for your openness as well. I know it isn't easy. You may have had this conversation loads of times, but clearly it doesn't just get easier because you've said these things before. And like, keep in touch, because we're not going to cover this every week on the podcast, but it would be a failure on our part if we didn't come back and discuss this at another time, some point.
Okay. Thank you for discussing the topic.
On the panel today, I'm very pleased to say we have Rosie Garthwaite, the digital documentaries producer for BBC Arabic. Rosie, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
David Harding is the international editor of The Independent. Hi, David.
Hello. Thanks again.
And Philippe Auclair, Football Weekly stalwart, the pod's moral guide. Hello. Hello, Philippe.
Good morning to you, Max.
David and Rosie, I wonder if I could first ask you a little bit about your work, your experiences in Qatar, the goal from and with the LGBTQI plus community. I mean, Rosie, I guess a polite way of saying, what are you doing on this podcast?
Okay, well, I was lucky enough to live in Qatar for, I think it was a total of 9 years, actually. I started at Al Jazeera, as so many did, young budding journalists out there. And then after a few years, decided I wanted to set up my own independent production company. I think at one point we were the only independent documentary production company, documentary and news company across the Gulf. And it was a really hard task. And a lot of people, as a result of the work that I was doing, some of it on record, but most of it off record, silently behind the scenes, would approach me with their stories. And so I had lots of friends, obviously, who were gay, but I also was introduced by them to people who were struggling. Actually, there was quite a crossover between young women who were struggling with their families and LGBTQI people who were struggling with their families and in so many other ways as well. So I got quite embedded in the community in the end. And also about halfway through my time in Qatar, I discovered that I was also gay. So that kind of that changed things a little bit, although that wasn't very well known until I returned to England about 5 years ago. So, yeah.
Can I ask, Rosie, when you discovered you were gay, were you, given your experiences, nervous of coming out in Qatar?
In my experience, because I lived in a relatively privileged bubble, and when people were in that bubble, well, it was a very privileged bubble, and when people were in that bubble with us at parties or out in the desert or whatever, it was a very safe place for people to be. And in my experience, there was a great freedom. And I think that many expats would say this to you over the centuries about being in everyone being there without their families and attachments and being able to be a version of themselves without limits. Although very clearly those limits are extremely real for Qataris and for many others living in Qatar with their families.
Mm. I mean, actually, David, that echoes what we've discussed already, that life is very different for Qataris as it is for expats. What's your experience of Qatar?
I was living in Qatar for about four and a half, five years. I was working as a journalist there, one of the few Western journalists. I was working for something called Agence France-Presse, which I'm sure Philip knows a lot about, but basically, can I called it roughly the equivalent of the French Reuters, something like that. So it's a global news agency. We set up an office there primarily because of 2022 and what was coming down the track.
And one of the difficulties in discussing this, I guess, David, is how little information there is about the gay community in Qatar.
Yes, and that mirrors lots of things that go on within Qatar. There's lots of things that sort of go on behind closed doors generally that shouldn't or aren't allowed to go on. It's a very closed space. It's a place where you don't reveal yourself very easily and very openly. It's so those people that I knew were LGBT whilst I was in Qatar certainly wouldn't discuss it openly. It would take basically a lot of discussion, sort of late night discussions to even talk about it. There were rumours of places you can go, or Rosie mentioned places in the desert, that kind of thing, where people could go and be themselves. It's a hidden aspect of life, and there's a lot of hidden aspects of life within Qatar. It's a place that if you do things that can be slightly against the strict nature of the place, you have to make sure that you're not seen to be doing them, and an LGBT fell within that category.
We have been in touch with a number of people from that community who have informed what we're trying to say, trying to explain, but that for reasons which are not reasons of Orientalism or neocolonialism, these voices, which obviously are the ones that we should be listening to, cannot be heard there, and therefore they cannot be heard here. So we had to be very, very careful about this. And this explains why we are talking about something which is somebody else's experience. And I know that for some people, it's very problematic to do that. But if you don't do it, we're not going to say anything.
You're going to hear testimonies throughout this pod from people from that community in Qatar, including the one you're just about to hear. They've all been voiced by actors.
I grew up knowing and believing that I was a boy. I was in a school where there was all girls, but there is no way I was a girl. I started to realize my reality is different. I used to think I would sleep and the next morning I would wake up a boy. I used to be bullied a lot for being boyish. Not like the other girls. The way I walk, the way I talk, everything. People used to bully me. I was in my 8th grade when I had a nervous breakdown. I said, "Can't you see I'm a boy?" If someone saw me and did not like my appearance, they can ask the police to take me. I am every day in danger because if someone knew that I am trans and Qatari, it is a life-threatening thing. I cannot give myself false hope. It's never going to be safe. There is no right for you to speak, to ask about your rights. I am living my purpose by just being me, every day. If I am going to stay in Qatar, I am going to lose. Even in 100 years, no one will get their rights to live here.
Human Rights Watch published a report the day before this recording, which is a few weeks before it goes out, stating that police in Qatar have arbitrarily detained and abused members of the LGBTQ community. It said it had documented 6 cases of severe and repeated beatings and 5 cases of sexual harassment in police custody between 2019 and 2022. The most recent case was in September. This was rejected by the Qatar government. An official said the allegations were categorically and unequivocally false. Qatar does not tolerate discrimination against anyone, and our policies and procedures are underpinned by a commitment to human rights for all. I wonder, Rosie, it's difficult to hear stories about, you know, beatings. And I know Dr. Nau's talked about conversion therapy and these kind of things. But it's probably important for listeners to hear what happens if you know, the police arrest a gay person.
We've been talking to members of the LGBT community and their supporters over the last few days about that report. But I think it's fair to say that if you are gay and you're Qatari of any level of society, you would be in fear of being arrested and that level, that side of your life being exposed, or whether you're arrested or not, just that, like, that side of your life being exposed in Qatar and around the region is a constant threat to many of these people.
When we talk about sports washing of any level, David, we talk about, one of the arguments is, oh, look, we, you know, they will, people will talk about these things. The community will get, you know, it'll be a, what's the right word? An enlightening experience for everyone in Qatar. And, you know, gay people will come to Qatar, gay fans, and everyone will see it'll be fine. And actually it'll be a step forward for, you know, gay people in Qatar. And I just wonder, from your experience, and Rosie obviously can come in this, in on this too, has the experience of the LGBTQI plus community got better or worse or stayed the same since Qatar was awarded the World Cup?
In my experience, I would say it's obviously more spoken about, just because of the noise around the Qatar World Cup. But what that's done on the ground, I don't know if it's had any particularly positive impact. It's things are sort of still the same, but also there's this element, there is within the conservative parts of Qatari society a fear about the World Cup, a fear around the World Cup of what sort of behaviours it will bring in. This is far broader than LGBT, of course. And there is some opposition to what could come in, and a sort of a belief that there's an imposition of Western values. And one of those things is tolerance or acceptance of LGBT. That's seen as a Western value that's being imposed upon people. And so those people within Qatar who are gay, who are local, who want basically equality or just want to be accepted by their own society, their own government, their own families, their own work colleagues, that kind of thing, they're viewed by many people as sort of, if I can put it like this, agents of the West. That they're trying to bring in things that are damaging and changing a society which is deeply traditional and conservative generally, which of course they're not. They're just trying to be accepted for what they are, for their sexuality. So the arguments around, or the noise around that people like us are making around the World Cup and around this issue, it's hard to say if there's had any great positive effect. And I think the response of the Qatari World Cup authorities is quite insulting in a way. They're basically saying they're going to hold their nose for a month or for 3.5 weeks. You can be gay if you like, but not too gay, and then we'll go back to how it all was. And that means nothing for local LGBT. And I don't know if we were sitting here in February or March 2023, if anything would have improved or maybe fearfully got worse.
I think also the thing that is that there are no, whilst on the migrant workers, there has been a small shift in the right direction when it comes to these rights and women's rights. I don't think there's been any shift. And if anything, I would say the country, perhaps along with much of the region, has grown more conservative in recent years. And unfortunately, the World Cup just puts a massive spotlight on the disparity between the way visitors, including expats that live there, are treated versus the Qataris, who have no chance of escape unless they seek asylum.
This was an incident today at the National Museum in Qatar where Peter Tatchell, a veteran LGBT rights activist, went to the country to show his protest against the discriminatory laws in the country. The fact is there are laws prohibiting same-sex relations, something highlighted significantly ahead of this World Cup.
One thing which, Max, which has been a recurrent theme, and, you know, Rosie and David have heard this probably far more often for far longer than I have, but was the great reluctance of people from the LGBT community, to use that word, in Qatar, towards any kind of activism during the World Cup. It's one thing that I was told time and time again, please don't come and wave your rainbow flags in the stadiums. please don't feel good about, you know, don't do things to feel good about yourselves and show what a hero you are for the LGBTQI plus people, because the people, all you risk is you're going to be put, perhaps arrested, perhaps pooped on a plane. That's it. End of story. But for the people who are there, it actually will make things worse. That I'm actually just being a conduit here for something that I've been told by a number of people a number of times, and which is something that, because it can be perceived, and actually quite logically, as a form, yes, of almost neocolonialism and really imposing values, which have got nothing to do with the traditional values of Qatari society, and some would say with also the tenets of Islam, and to impose that for a few weeks and then go and, you know, and we don't care about the consequences.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned religion, and it's interesting, you know, just, it's actually quite a homophobic world, Rosie, when you look at it. Like 69 countries have laws that criminalize homosexuality. A lot of them are based on like interpretations of scriptures in those countries, be it Islam or Christianity or whatever religion. You know, there are only 28 countries in the world that recognize same-sex marriages, and I think only 81 as of 2020 that have laws against discrimination in the workplace. I suppose it's important to say it isn't just Qatar. Dr. Naz, David, talked about sort of official spies type of thing. So, like, you know, set going on dates, like trying to catch people out. Is that something that you, you know, have you spoken to people in the community about that?
Yes, he's not the only person to say it. Rosie hinted about a few comments ago about the digital aspect of this, which has made things even more perilous. If for some reason you were trying to meet somebody else, either in a social setting or you know sort of hooking up for a date that happens elsewhere. If you're doing that digitally, people have said that Qatar has said to me that this is a no-go because it's so scary. You don't know who you're talking to. Don't know basically what this person's intentions are. If you could meet somebody and suddenly be arrested, beaten, there is a real fear aspect of that because, as we've hinted at quite a few times now, that there isn't a community as such. It's individuals trying to make their way through life on their own and doing this. So they have to sort of make that assessment. There's no doubt that sort of cyber spy software is so now much more sophisticated than it was just several years ago that makes it problematic.
I actually haven't heard of an arrest after one of these incidents, but I do know that people live in fear of this. And I think, you know, that living in that fear, it does awful things to you.
In this feudal society, you have to operate through that bureaucracy. They put a carrot in front of you. They can blackmail you. They can abuse you if you're found out. Say this company wanted to employ me in marketing. I couldn't because I studied in something different. This is how it works. Everything must go through one single ministry. Everything must be registered and controlled. This is what this country does to you. You feel indentured permanently against your will. Even the act of committing suicide isn't one we can make with complete autonomy. That would be our parents' reputation in the coffin with us. There is nothing for us to live for. It's not like there is a light at the end of the tunnel. There is none. We're in this long, limitless, dark tunnel, and we keep going, thinking we might find something, but it's not there. I was never allowed to do anything with my sexuality, and therefore I became handicapped, almost arrested in my development. If I want to have sex, I don't have anywhere I can go. I live with my parents. I don't have the money to afford a hotel. If I stayed in a hotel, my ID would be scanned. There are cameras everywhere, so I'm always on edge. The fact that we have a police state that surveils us means that we do not have the luxury of doing basic, mundane things. It is intangible, but the obstacles to intimacy are ever present. There are no places where gay people can congregate, What you see in Qatar is all smoke and mirrors. There is a coordinated, coercive determination to conceal everything. If Qatar was a movie genre, it would be psychological horror. That's why it's so dangerous for me. There is no joy in being a martyr for a cause I didn't consciously choose. In being raped throughout an entire lifetime in silent view of everyone and not being able to speak about it.
The testimonies that we're going to play out that have been voiced and they're anonymous, I know that it's really affected you just talking to those people. I just wonder how you found these people, if you can even say. I don't know.
No, I don't want to.
Okay.
I don't want to. It was helped by people who had who introduced me to some of them. And then, you know, it goes from one to the next and it's about building some trust. I have to say, I got a little bit paranoid about that. But also, I have to say, yes, I found some of the conversations extremely, extremely difficult to have. And, you know, because I thought I knew a bit. I realized I knew nothing. And, or rather what I knew was, it's not about it's illegal, you could be punished by prison. No, it's about when you start talking to the people who are in this situation, it's about being taken by the hand into a hellscape. There's no other word for it.
Finally, is there any good that can come from this World Cup, David?
That's a very difficult question. I've asked that to people within Qatar itself. I think it's proven very, very problematic for Western activists, those who are far more sort of full-time, as well as those who are sort of might just pick up a rainbow flag on November 20th. It's something that is a huge problem for Qatari, local gay Qataris, because this is something that is a struggle that they have to succeed in themselves. How that they do that is very unclear. And at the time, and as we said, they could face a potential backlash because of all the noise that's being made in the West specifically about this issue. Having spoken to local people quite a lot on this, I don't know specifically where any sort of great success or anything, to answer your question, Max, can be found immediately.
Philippe, as always, thanks, mate.
Thank you.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rosie, thank you.
Thank you.
So in response to some of the allegations made, we wanted to get in touch with FIFA, the organising committee, etc., and hear all the statements. Again, it's quite long, but it is worth listening to. A FIFA spokesperson told us that FIFA's position on inclusivity and the protection of human rights is unequivocal. Discrimination of any kind on account of sexual orientation is strictly prohibited. They told us that FIFA strives to, quote, promote diversity within its organisation and in all of its activities and events. With regards to the World Cup in Qatar, a FIFA spokesperson said that Qatar as a host country is fully aware of its responsibility to adhere to FIFA's expectations and requirements on human rights, equality and non-discrimination. They told us that FIFA and its Qatari counterparts are implementing a strategic programme of concrete measures to achieve this objective. The measures will be in place for LGBTQI plus fans and allies to enjoy the tournament in a welcoming and safe environment. When we reached out to the Qatari government, a spokesperson told us they were extremely disappointed by our decision to deliberately exclude Qatari and Arab voices, and that the assumption that the safety of any person testifying about their experiences in Qatar would be at risk is an unfounded and baseless claim that goes against Qatar's core principles of dialogue and engagement as the best means to effect change. They said many of the allegations put forward are categorically false and paint an inaccurate picture of the reality in Qatar. They told us that Qatar is a diverse and welcoming country where discrimination is never tolerated, and that there have never been reports of violence targeting people based on their background or beliefs in Qatar. They said that allegations of arbitrary arrests and detainments are categorically and unequivocally false, and that the Qatari government does not operate or license any treatment or conversion centres. A statement on behalf of the Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy said they were committed to delivering an inclusive and discrimination-free FIFA World Cup experience that is welcoming, safe, and accessible to all participants, attendees, and communities in Qatar and around the world. They said that everyone is welcome in Qatar, but we are a conservative country and any public display of affection, regardless of orientation, is frowned upon. We simply ask for people to respect our culture. We reached out to representatives for David Beckham, who did not respond. Previous reporting by the Metro implies that following publication of an earlier story, Dr. Nasser's account was unblocked shortly after publication. And an anonymous source close to Beckham has also been reported saying David believes in Qatar's commitment to progress and that the World Cup can affect significant positive change. This part of the programme on the LGBTQ plus community was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer was Max Sanderson.
This is The Guardian.